for meditation. And now on to tonight's talk, which is... how does the Pali go? Yes. Yad anicham tam dukam tad anatta. Which is, as I'm sure you're well aware, the one of the core teachings of the Buddha, along with the Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, and Karma. One of the core teachings of the Buddha was something known as the three characteristics. Anicca, dukkha, anatta, which means, when you say it as he did in his brief discourses, it means all things are inconstant and impermanent and subject to change, and because they are, all things are unsatisfactory, and because they are, all things are inherently empty of a lasting identity. And I'm going to go through this all, so don't worry about it. But the Pali is yad anicham tad dukkham tan tad anatta. And basically what it means is that all the things we experience, they're conditioned. They arise and they pass. It doesn't matter whether it's mountains or insects' life, buildings, anything that we think of that has been arisen, has come together from various parts, is changing, it's going to fall apart. Now, it's very tempting, and a lot of teachers just present this teaching as about the world outside. But the Buddha really doesn't primarily teach about the world outside so much as he teaches about the mind, how the mind creates this sense of inconstancy, this sense of change. Even things that are very changing extremely slowly in life, we experience very, very differently. For example, you move into a new apartment. Oh my goodness, I love this place. I want to live here forever. Look how big it is, though. I love the light that's streaming in my own place. Or there's another roommate there, but still I've got a wonderful room. Cut to 6 months later. Oh my God, I can't believe I moved into this tiny little rat trap with the walls closing in on me. Now, it would be very limiting to think what's happened is, well, the room has changed or the apartment has changed. That's not really what the teaching is deeply about. What the teaching is about is that the way we experience everything in life is constantly changing. There's a great study that they did with businessmen who were very wealthy, and they found out that these people, who, when they made their first million, apparently they experienced a certain amount of joy and sense of success. But then to get the same amount of joy and success, they had to make exponentially more on the next deal. And then exponentially more. The meaning of it was no longer the same. The same thing with anything we get. We get a new car and it's shiny. I've never owned a new car, but if I did, it would be shiny. And I would perhaps look at that car and think, oh, this is a wonderful car. I'm so happy I bought a car, which is so unlikely, but for the sake of this tonight's talk, I'll pretend that I'm that guy. But then a few months later, I would just get into it. I wouldn't have that moment of sudden when I walked out of my apartment seeing the car and thinking, you know, oh, what a wonderful thing. I probably wouldn't even notice it. It would just become something that it was a way to work. And then eventually it would become something that I was bored with and would want to get rid of. So the way we relate to things is constantly changing, along with the things themselves. So anything we get is getting older, it's comprised of components that can fall apart, and then the way we relate to it is changing. The underlying feelings, gut feelings, the underlying mood that we're in as we relate to things changes. For example, I'm sure you've all had times when the phone has rung and you felt really, you've got so much to do. And that phone ringing sound is, oh my God, go away. Leave me alone. Why is everybody needing something from me? Ah, another intrusion. On another occasion, you might be lonely. You might have very little happening, and the phone rings, and it's a welcome sound. Oh, yes, people love me. Bring me that phone. It's the same exact sound, or pretty much the same exact sound, but the underlying feelings, the underlying mood, the underlying thoughts, everything, the mind state has changed the way that phone sounds. Just as the way we relate to the car, the way we relate to the apartment. So everything we are experiencing is changing. The mind does that. Why does the mind do this but not notice? That's a big question, right? One thing is that the mind is set up for novelty. The way it was created and set up to survive, the way the earth was 50,000 years ago when everything was really dangerous, and the brain really hasn't changed very much since then. In fact, it hasn't changed really at all in terms of the way it's structured. But the mind is set up to reward us with dopamine, to find new sources of happiness, new things to worry about, new. So the mind likes to figure out things and then not pay attention to it anymore. It likes to think, okay, I can put a label, a perception on this person, and then they will not change. This person is an asshole. I don't like them. They'll never say anything good. This person is terrific, smart. They'll never say anything stupid. This is my funny friend. They'll never be unfunny or boring. This is my not-so-funny friend. They'll never say anything funny. The mind loves to label, put a perception on things so that it doesn't have to pay attention to those things very much, so that it can go off and search for ever new sources of sex, food, and threats. That's basically pretty much it, right? I mean, I think that's what the brain is set up to help us survive. So, the general basic core message here is that we're looking for something to bring us lasting sources of security and food and all that stuff. And this causes us suffering. Why? Because if we don't get it, we suffer. But if we do get that thing, it changes. We become bored with it. Eventually, we don't get what we want from it, or it changes, and that shiny new car suddenly becomes a clunker. So either way, whatever we attach to externally for lasting peace, security, and happiness, it's going to fail us. Buddhism is pretty much the only spiritual path, maybe along with Hinduism, that really takes this sense of impermanence and really takes it to its most deep-reaching conclusions. There's a lot of people that notice change and that things are constantly changing. The founder of Greek philosophy, Heraclitus, but the Buddha said things are changing, therefore they're unsatisfactory. Even our own minds are constantly changing to the degree that there's nothing in our minds over the years that gives us a lasting identity. We are empty of that lasting core soul or identity. When we reflect on it, this kind of impermanence can have a real profound change in the way we live our lives. And I'm going to talk just a little bit about the practical implications of this the practical implications of knowing that things are impermanent. The first is that when we experience a great loss, a death, somebody we know goes away or dies, or we get a terrible illness, or one of the great losses, the Buddha referred to these as teachers. It's very unusual to think of loss and death as something to learn from. But it's meant, in fact, to, when we use it skillfully, rather than to say, why is this happening to me? Why am I losing my friends? This happens to everybody. Death, loss, grief. It's part of the inevitables of life. So the skillful way is to feel the feelings, and then, rather than to turn it into a story of why is this happening to me, instead to learn from the impermanence of people, of relationships, families, jobs, all the things that we tend to cling to are fragile. And to see, am I prioritizing my life in the right way? Am I really paying attention and getting worked up about things that are important when I'm at work? Am I getting thrown by things that are important? Or when somebody who's a friend disagrees with me, am I getting tossed and thrown about? Is this issue that I'm getting worked up about, is it going to be something that's important to me perhaps when I'm on my deathbed? Or if this was my last night, would I want this to be the stuff that was going on in my mind? It's a reflection we have to make over and over and over again. I've told the story of the guy who got the dire diagnosis of an inoperable brain tumor. And he wrote that it completely changed everything that he saw of as important. And he no longer got into fights and arguments and contentious disagreements over all the things that he had. And then a few weeks later, he got a call, and it turns out they had completely misread his chart, and he wasn't dying at all. And he said by the time he got into the cab and was being driven back home, he got into an argument with the cab driver about what was the fastest route. That quickly did the sense of priority, the sense of what's important, fall away and get replaced with this sense of it's me against everybody else. I've got to, you know, just make sure I, you know, get there quicker, faster, and get as much as I can. That mindset that's foisted upon us by the world. The world really doesn't want us to see how impermanent things are. It really wants us to believe that a 401k and a big house will bring us lasting peace and security. It's in the vested interest of the economy and the hegemonic order that controls such things that you not reflect on impermanence, that you not learn from loss, from death, from the fragility and the lack of constancy that is the core nature of life. It's in their vested interest, there's no really they, but it's in just the way that our society is structured, that we are taught to believe that we are guaranteed to have a certain amount of time and a certain amount of years retired and all that. And the truth is that none of that is guaranteed at all. It all can go away very, very quickly. And the things we turn to can go away. So another learning, not just from the big things, but is to learn from the lesser disappointments, the cars and computers and things that fall apart, get lost, get broken, get stolen. The things that, the jobs that end, the relationships that are new that get broken up. These, the stores that we like that get closed, or our favorite cheap restaurant that goes away. All these little impermanences that we experience that we can just feel, well, why is this happening to me? Or this is just so unfair, and that's the degree of learning that we get. But really, these frustrations can actually be preparations for the bigger disappointments that old age, sickness, loss, grief, death, all that will bring. We don't have to wait for somebody or something that's important to be ripped away. We can use these frustrations in life. Even things as, you know, small as something that you like getting misplaced, or when you lose the keys, or anything that human beings do. Instead of getting caught up in what I sometimes automatically do, which is, you know, God damn it, what's wrong with me? How could I do this? How could I lose my stupid fucking phone again? I lose it every day, but instead to see, okay, this is the degree of attachment I have to this, to the world, to these things. This is the degree of this is how overbalanced I am externally as opposed to internally. There's a great teaching story of Ajahn Chah, who had a mug, and he used to tell his students over and over and over again how everything was impermanent. It's all impermanent. Don't get attached to anything. And finally, one of his students had the temerity to say, but Ajahn, you love your mug. You're always with your mug. What's going on here? Why do you get to have a mug? Nobody would ever touch Ajahn Chah's mugs. The rest of the mugs are interchangeable, but Ajahn Chah had his mug. And Ajahn Chah said, the difference between you and me is that I know this mug is already broken, and you don't. What does that mean? What Ajahn Chah is saying is that he already knew that there was going to come a day when he was going to reach for his mug and it was going to drop from his hands, or somebody was going to push it over, and he wasn't going to be that attached to it that it was going to cause suffering. He was going to have the same attachment level to his things that you have to a game of Scrabble or to a sunset, which you know are not going to bring you lasting peace. They're just something that you enjoy, but you know are not going to be the sources of your lasting happiness. That's the degree of attachment he was teaching his students to have. And when you do have that level of attachment, when I have that level of attachment, then we can relate to things. As Blake the poet says, we can kiss the joy as it flies away. We can kiss the joy as it flies away. We can kiss the beauties of life, knowing that those things will eventually slip away. They will fall apart. Now, there's an even additional teaching of impermanence. Just as we're talking about the big impermanences of loss and death, and the little disappointments of something breaking, or, you know, something that we like being lost, or whatever, then there's just the moment-by-moment impermanence of the way, if we experience mindfully what's going on inside of us, we can actually observe how our thoughts, how our gut sensations, our feelings, how everything is in flux, even pain. which we think of as being solid, when you really focus in on it closely, it's always changing. Anybody who's ever had a chronic pain, one of the ways to work with it is to actually focus in rather than to try to push away the sensations, to take some time to really find, if you can, the center of where the pain is or where the center of any feeling in the body is. And when you do, what you'll notice are all these little sensations that are constantly changing, that there is no thing there, no core inner pain or sensation that is lasting. Everything that we investigate on a moment-by-moment basis is changing. Again, all this stuff can sound intellectually very easy. It's very easy to say, yeah, I know everything's impermanent. I know that everything in my life is subject to change. Yeah, I get it. We're all going to die someday. If it was that easy, every single human being would have been the Buddha. We all would be completely have a level of detachment that was appropriate towards life. But the truth is that while it's easy to intellectually say, yeah, I get it, again, it's so easy to fall back because the mind is so set up to fall into the assumptions that we can plan and take for granted things. Now, we might shoot back, but it's important for me to make plans. I can't not make plans. I have to assume that I can plan a trip if I want to take a trip. I have to plan and assume that I can live for another few months so that I can, you know, go to Vancouver or wherever you want to go, Mexico in the winter, if we can afford it. The answer is that there's nothing wrong with making plans so long as, just as we talked about with things, we hold on to them lightly enough to know that they're all subject to change too. As Ajahn Amaro once said at a talk I was listening to, he's under the habit of, rather than saying, I'm going to England next year, he got into the habit of saying, if all goes as planned, I'm going to England next year. Even that slight little turn of speech, which might sound like nothing, reminds us and brings a new perspective that every plan we make, that everything we are taking for granted, is really very contingent and much more fragile than we often care to admit. Now, this is not supposed to be a bummer of a teaching. It's actually one of the most crucial things so that we develop what the Buddha called a sense of dismay at what we've been over-attaching to, so that we can instead focus on things that do bring us lasting peace and security. What are those things? Not only are we trying to develop those things when we meditate and when we mindfully throughout the day keep aware of our bodies and relax ourselves and make sure that we're bringing a peaceful state into the world. But there are practices such as being virtuous, refraining from the things that cause us lasting suffering. Things like refraining from killing. If you've been killing, I suggest you stop. If you've been stealing, it's not a good strategy for lasting peace. You might want to investigate that. Lying creates so much mental agitation and doesn't help us see the true ramifications. When we're caught and when we lie, we're not owning up to the long-term ramifications of our actions, and we're not giving ourselves the opportunity to grow. When we cause harm through to ourselves or others through intoxication or unskillful sex, doesn't mean no sex, just unskillful, where you're causing harm to someone or yourself. These are not sources of lasting peace. Gratitude, generosity with ourselves and with others, goodwill, forgiveness. All these practices are things that have no side effects. And in the long term, they create a mind that is so much more peaceful than the things that are subject to fall apart. We are never short of an opportunity to be generous with ourselves or others. There's always some opportunity to express gratitude for simply being alive or for simply having the skillful friends that we've accumulated or for there being food that we can eat, which generally came at somebody's expense, picking it and shipping it and putting it out. There's always an opportunity for us to forgive. Because there's always unskillfulness happening out in the world. So none of these things can suddenly be ripped away from us. So again, this is not a radical teaching and urging you to, in the sense, give up everything you own and join a monastery unless you want to. But it is a teaching urging us to learn from the disappointments, from the large to small that happen in life so that we can develop a perspective that in the long term will serve us, that in the long term will guide us towards actions and thoughts that bring us peace rather than frustration at losing one thing after another after another. So thanks for listening. I hope you got something out of tonight's talk, and now's your turn to ask any questions. And that's about it. Yeah, if you could, somebody can turn on the lights in the back.